Third Commando's screening the city, while Count Salgo is building a more credible force of Wilderlords. Of course, all of that may change when the weather warms enough to get armies through the Wilderlands, she added, disturbed. If Shirul was preparing a major offensive, we would have caught word of it, I said more confidently than I felt. Now that Korbal was a player in the game, Shirul was not the only foe we had to be wary of. That didn't mean he wasn't still an existential threat. You've done admirably in Verone, Pentandra, I said sincerely. Between you, Salgo, and Angriel, the place might actually survive.
It will do more than that, she snapped.
Anguin isn't content to be known to history as merely the Orphan Duke. He plots to restore his rule over all Alshar, which is why you must be sure to consult with him and gain his permission before you do anything crazy with Olam Saheri.
Why? Is there tribute in arrears?
I joked. Because it's technically part of Anguin's realm, and conducting operations within Alshar need to be cleared with the Alshari court, she lectured. It's not that I anticipate any resistance to the plan, she added, but after all the goodwill you've built up with Anguin, it would be a shame to waste some of it because you were too busy to ask permission.
Point taken, I sighed. Please tell His Grace to expect a social call in the near future. One among many, it seems, I'm going to be making. All right, this beast has borne me all the way to Tarragwen now. Most of the Astarsi Order is assembled to brief me about their adventures in Olam Saheri.
Please extend the lad's my thanks and the gratitude of His Grace, she replied.
Just the kind of good gesture a good court wizard makes.
He is anxious for their return to his service.
One deadly mission at a time, please. I've only got a few, Knights Magi. I don't want to use them up. Tarragwen Keep is the headquarters for the Astarsi Order of Knights Magi, which mostly meant it was a place for Tyndall and Rondel to hang out when they wanted more quiet than Sevendor Town afforded. It's a modest little mountain tower house, adequate as a protected manor, but hardly big enough to withstand more than a raid. I supported the boys' rash actions when they'd captured the castle, with their confederate and fellow founder, Sir Festaren, and a cross-dressing goblin. Long story. I'd only told them to scout because it guarded one of only two deposits of snowstone outside of Sevendor proper, and I wanted it in secure hands. Since then, the place had become their unofficial clubhouse and war department in their fight against the Brotherhood of the Rat. Those were evil pirates and gangsters who'd gravely offended the lads a few years ago. They don't have very forgiving natures. But they did know how to fight, and fight with both courage and cunning. They'd made some valuable allies in their skirmishes last summer, and exploited them to the point of impoverishing the criminal gang and disrupting their operations. In the process, they discovered an insidious plot by the undead to invade an Ultramar, and at least slowed it down. But then they pushed their luck. They wanted to send an expedition into the heart of the Shadow, to the mountain fortress of Korbal the Necromancer, Olam Saheri. It was a bold, dangerous, and audacious plan, but I'd authorized it. And to give them the best possible chance, I'd additionally authorized the inclusion of Nothua Vanaran, formerly Lady Mask, in their party. Apparently that had been instrumental. As I'd explained to Sister Bemia, I'd checked in with the lads as soon as I was back, and had gotten a brief report from them. But there was much they were unwilling to reveal to me, even in mind-to-mind conversation. So, as I walked under the freshly scrubbed gateway of Tarragwen Keep and into the neatly kept little bailey, I had little idea what to expect from this briefing. Stumbling across three dwarves working busily in a shed near the hall door was not one of them. At first I thought that they were Karshak, perhaps a few of the fellows who hired out on their days off from the mountain. But then I realized that their massive mane and beards were black, not brown, and their features were unlike the Karshak in some ways, and I knew who they were. Khazari, the Alon Dradrien, more commonly known as the Iron Folk. I tried not to look surprised, merely smiled warmly at the three and kept going. I had no idea what crap had happened in Olam Saheri, but apparently it was quite a story.
Baron Minelan,
came the voice of Sir Ganyalan, the steward of the Order. He more or less hated me, but we had come to terms after his former companions and employers tried to kill him.
Now he worked for the boys, and was more or less in charge of Tarragwan Keep when they weren't around.
"We've been waiting," he added coolly.
"I had business to attend to," I answered absently, as one of the servants took my mantle. "But this is important." "That's what we thought too," called Tyndall from Great Hall. 4 weeks ago."
"Join us, master," Rondell called, in a less judgmental voice. "We'll tell you all about it."
And they did. For this meeting, Tyndall and Rondell had included Gareth, Nothua, and their friend Sir Atapal the Cat of Enultramar, thief and shadow mage, their newest member. One after another, they gave me a detailed account of the sortie to Olam Saheri, reported the terrifying meeting between our two greatest enemies, and confirmed the presence of Princess Radin in a tower cell.
"She was right there,"
Tyndall grumbled. "I knew Ironfolk vassals got us as close as we could come, but it was a little hard to execute a rescue with Shirul and Korbal throwing a bloody festival in the streets."
"Too bad you didn't,"
I pointed out. "King Rad has declared he will grant 2 rich Gilmoran baronies to the man who rescues Radin and brings her safely home."
Tyndall shook his head.
"Oh, no,"
he sighed. "I wish I'd known that while I was there. It would have made me think on the matter for another 5 whole seconds before I ran screaming from that horrible place."
"It's going to be difficult to extract her," Rondell agreed with a sigh. "But the good news is that she's undervalued as a prisoner. They aren't really interrogating her, from what the Iron Folk managed to tell us. They're just holding her as prize and hostage."
"That's a blessing, then," I nodded, "because we are indeed going to go after her, in Olam Saheri."
"Master, you have 1 barony already," Tyndall pointed out. "Is that not enough?"
"It's not for the real estate," I promised. "It's for a distraction." Rondell and Gareth, in particular, looked at me sharply.
"A distraction for what?"
Rondell said, beating his friend by a half second. "Another mission entirely," I said, tapping my fingers on the table. "Yes, we should go after Radin, if only to deny her use to the enemy. But that rescue can also serve to keep the eyes of the necromancer away from where I don't want them to be. While you ladies and gentlemen will be performing the rescue, I will be conducting my own business in Olam Saheri."
"Well, that certainly sounded cryptic,"
Nothua said with a snort. Since she'd fairly won a witchstone at the last spellmonger's trial, soundly defeating every obstacle in her path, and dueling 2 opponents on the trail to a standstill, she was once again a high mage. Giving her a chance to use that new power, now under my oath, was the final step toward me releasing her as my prisoner.
"It was meant to be,"
I replied. "I'm gratified that your mission was successful, because my own was even more successful. And in completing it, I gained us another ally, and, more importantly, a much greater understanding of the stakes of this war. There is much going on of which we are not aware. In order to counter the danger, I need to penetrate into areas of Olam Saheri that are going to be very difficult to get to, by design. That mission, which is far more important than Radin's rescue, is mine."
"So, you want us to go bursting back into Olam Saheri, which is filled with goblins, hobgoblins, trolls, undead? Oh, and did we mention wyverns?"
demanded Gareth, annoyed.
"Because there were wyverns. I thought those things were a myth," he said accusingly. "The entire place is just swarming with flocks of vicious flying wyverns."
"Don't forget the dragons," Atapal added helpfully, brushing his overlong white hair out of his lavender eyes with a finger.
"Oh, yes, the dragons,"
the young wizard added, as if an afterthought. "Or the necromancer himself," Tyndall pointed out.
"There's that as well,"
Gareth agreed. "And you want us to take on this mission as a distraction?"
"You have understood my direction perfectly,"
I agreed smugly, while the lad went pale. Gareth wasn't cut out to be a war mage, though he knew more war magic than any non-practicing wizard I knew. He was a thaumaturge of powerful thought, an enchanter of note, and he had an administrative knack that was a rare and special talent in a subordinate. Thankfully, the others were more enthusiastic.
"I don't think we honestly have the strength to pull that off," Rondell said with a sigh, a moment later. "I mean, we're good. We beat the snot out of the Brotherhood of the Rat and stung the undead pretty badly, but, Master, Olam's Sir Harry?
I agree, I nodded. Your current membership is inadequate to the task. I therefore challenge you to increase your membership. We're going to need a lot of very smart, very talented folk to help us on this quest, and we need to start gathering them and training them now. While we're scouting and gathering intelligence on the place, I want the Astarsi Order to recruit worthy and powerful war magi and knights magi to train for the mission. But do it discreetly, I warned, away from prying eyes and big ears. This must be a secret mission until it's successful. There are too many parties arrayed against us who would welcome the opportunity to spoil our plans out of spite and malice, if for no other reason. Should we prove successful, we will upset a good many of their plans as well. So, keep it under the wands, I said, using the wizardly shorthand for keep your damn mouth shut. That's a big order, Rondell said, shaking his head. I know a few fellows who might be game, Tyndall considered, cocking his head in contemplation.
As do I, nodded Nothua.
And we have heard of some sports who might be worth interviewing, Rondell agreed, reluctantly. He groaned.
Ish's tits, Master Min. How big of a force do we require?
I'm thinking at least a score. Maybe two, I decided. Not so much cavalry, but they need to know how to ride. And fight. Fight most of all.
All right, Gareth said, nodding his head. I'm out.
He got up from his seat, pushing the heavy wooden chair back from the trestle.
What?
Snapped Tyndall, confused. I am out of this, the wizard said, indicating the entire affair. Look, I helped you guys out with the Brotherhood for one reason only. To try to attract Dara's attention and prove to her how brave and whatever it is she's looking for. I did it for her.
But you saw how she reacted at Yule,
he continued, a fire in his eyes.
You heard what happened. She barely acknowledged everything I did, while she and Fastaran played Lord and Lady of the Castle all through the holiday.
It wasn't her fault, Rondell said defensively. She was forced to hold the Yule court in Min's absence, and with Sire Kay gone, Fess had to step in and be Castellan.
I know, Gareth said darkly. Once again, they get pushed together, while I languish in the background, waiting patiently for my turn to dance.
Aye, she did dance with you,
Tyndall pointed out uneasily.
And do you recall how that went? Demanded the wizard, tensely.
Everyone at the table winced.
Apparently I missed an eventful court, I observed.
With all due respect, Master, Gareth continued easily, this is an order of knights magi of which I am not. It is a haven for war magi, a profession for which I have proven unsuited. So, while it was highly educational to risk my fucking life on your behalf in order to impress a girl, that girl remains unimpressed, he said, as dignified as he could manage. Therefore, my service here is at an end.
Coward,
Nothua said under her breath.
Just because you're a girl doesn't mean I won't strike you,
Gareth said bitterly.
Just because you're a girl doesn't mean I won't strike you back,
she replied acidly, her hand straying to her new mage blade,
and end your life.
Gareth turned and stormed out of the hall. Rondell started to rise to follow, but Tyndall wisely held him back.
Let him go, he advised. He's just worked up.
What happened? I demanded.
Just what he said, Rondell sighed.
He risked his life in an ultramar at our behest to topple the Brotherhood. He proved remarkably helpful and instrumental to the quest. He did it in hopes his deeds would translate to interest in Dara's eyes. But she's smitten with Sir Fastaran and enjoys Gareth only for his friendship. I winced. Ouch.
Yes.
Let him go, I sighed heavily. He's right. He isn't a war mage, or a knight mage. I'll find other uses for him. The rest of you, I said, pouring another cup of wine, need to explain to me about the three dwarves in your front shed. Chapter 4 Plans and Preparations. The days after the fateful message arrived were even busier for my staff,
as preparations for the state visit began in earnest. I spent most of the mornings overseeing the transfer of my valuables into the mountain vaults and seeing to some business details that needed my attention. Sire Kay had been staying up deep into the night every night, and was back at it again at dawn. You can't prepare for the prince and his family by just sweeping the streets clear of dung and dusting off the furniture. Brigger's Day was already a major attraction for Sevendor, the largest regular event held here now, save for the magic fair in the fall. In the few years since the Everfire had appeared in town, folk from across the Bontal Vales made pilgrimage to see the officially sanctioned sacred site of a freestanding, miraculous pillar of eternal flame placed there by the fire goddess Brigger's inspiration, favour and grace. There was more to the story than that, but I'm not one to upset an emerging myth. Besides, my brother-in-law ran the bakery next to the Temple of the Everfire, just off the market square, and he made a killing every year selling seasonal pastries in the shape of Brigger's Cross. Last year, Bannermore told me, when I inquired, over 2,000 people had made the pilgrimage to the Everfire at the end of winter, praying for a variety of rustic boons, a bountiful lambing, good skill in smithing, blessings for a foster child, and the occasional request for righteous vengeance. The temple's priestesses, of whom I was a generous patron, escorted the pious through a line around the Everfire at a safe distance, and directed a ritual that included abandoning burdens by burning them away, purification by incense, and submission of written prayers to the flame who burneth bright. Along the way, the pilgrims were exposed to the serene and tasteful artistic renderings of Brigger's myths, brilliantly painted by talented Remiran limners on the snowstone walls of the temple. They were serenaded by two brigandine nuns playing harp and flute, while an older priestess, with a beautiful voice, read inspirational poetry. At the end of the ceremony, they were gifted an iron pilgrim's medallion with Brigger's Cross on the obverse and the snowflake of Sevendor on the reverse. They were also strongly encouraged to donate an offering to the temple by a pretty young priestess with a lovely smile, big boobs, and a large wooden begging bowl. The holiday was the temple's single biggest source of revenue, outside of direct patronage by Sevendor's folk, and lucrative fees from my family's bakery, the smiths of Sevendor, and various ecclesiastical services. The temple was not poor, and the high priestess used the event to fund several charitable services for the townsfolk. Since their biggest patron was the son of a baker, and a high-ranking lay member of their order, most of the effort, besides supporting three nuns every year, was being devoted to subsidizing my brother's-in-law bakery's apprenticeship program, not smithcraft or poetry. My family now had 9 apprentices toiling at the ovens in town, under my father's expert eye. It was a lucrative arrangement for all involved. The temple got an influx of funds, the bakery made huge sales, the pilgrims were able to unload their burdens and appeal for divine favor, as well as enjoy an expertly crafted pastry, and the town got the benefit of an influx of outside coin at the very beginning of the agricultural season, when it needed it the most. Tavard's visit would compound all of that. His party alone would be huge, I suspected, and the visiting parties of local dignitaries would strain the resources of Sevendor's upscale accommodations to the limit. That would be good news for my other brother-in-law, Lord Sagal, Alia's sister Ella's husband, if you're keeping track, who ran a lucrative trade in hostelries from his estate of Southridge. But that's where the headaches began. The prince's pilgrimage would attract far more than the usual number of commoners, I knew. I was figuring at least double last year's attendance. That was troubling, because Sevendor just didn't have the regular accommodations for that kind of influx of visitors, not during the cold, rainy end of winter. We'd have to resort to tents on the commons, as we did with the magic fair. In order to head off the strain on municipal services, I consulted with Lord Mayor Bannermore that evening, after an afternoon meeting in his office stretched out into detail after detail, and bumped into the evening. The former foot wizard, now ennobled burgher, public official and growing commercial power, had 4 desks in his office chamber, each covered with parchments detailing all of his business interests. Shelves of folios and account books were interspersed with wine racks of his growing collection of vintages. A big iron chest, filled with silver,
sat near to an even stronger box of gold, both as heavily enchanted against theft as he could make them. He had two personal assistants now, clerks who ran his day-to-day business. That was in addition to the clerk he had for his municipal duties over at the town hall, and Gareth, his assistant spellwarden and general troubleshooter. There were six more men in the hall downstairs in the warehouse. Bannermore's counting house always buzzed with activity. So did Bannermore's mind.
"This is a big deal, Min,"
he assured me enthusiastically when he poured that first cup of wine. Bannermore was beside himself at the potential opportunities of Tavard's surprise visit. He got out the gold chalices, the serious ass-kissing ones. I felt honored. He filled them with a hearty Gilmoran red, good for afternoon affairs and plotting economic strategy.
"It will be expensive up front, of course, but we'll make a huge enough profit on the back end to make it worthwhile."
Bannermore seemed to think I would balk at authorizing the expense of a worthy presentation of the town we'd built together from scratch. I cut him off. "Of course it will," I nodded, "and a boon to the local economy. Please understand that's not my highest concern," I pointed out.
"It doesn't hurt," he offered. "Look, if we play this right,
we'll make money," I finished for him with a sigh.
"Granted. Let's go over the preparations you've made first, and then we can discuss the potential revenue streams. Let's start with where we're going to house everyone."
I ended up staying through the rest of the afternoon and three bottles of wine before we retired across his street to dine as the sun was disappearing behind the ridge and the town's mage lights were beginning to form. I rarely pass up an opportunity to dine at Bannermore's private table at the Alembic, especially when he mentioned the new Tal Alon cook, who was picking up some Remiran dishes. Usually the quality of the service and the wine cellar alone was enough to capture my attention. As it happened, we were joined by Masters Olmeg and Loico Venaren, the former concluding a tour of Sevendor for the new court wizard, who Bannermore eagerly invited to our meal. I certainly didn't object. It was an unofficial, spontaneous gathering of some of the leading wizards in residence of Sevendor, so it was an opportune time to talk shop. Bannermore sauntered into the decadently appointed inn. He'd built three small but elegant rooms above for special clients, and began calling unnecessary orders to the staff. In moments, we were settled at the beautiful wooden table he claimed as his own private domain, a cool mage light hanging overhead, cups and plates distributed for us. A young lad near the front played a quiet tune on a viol, while my nose began to entertain me with the promise of a delicious meal. The castle's kitchen is first rate, but Bannermore had a craving for luxury only a life of hardship can inspire. Besides, I always eat for free at Bannermore's table. Mage Lord's prerogative. I began the impromptu meeting by cautioning our host about becoming overly friendly with Tavard's party while they were here. "I have no intention of betraying Sevendor's interests to Tavard," the merchant mage snorted, when I brought up the possibility as the first course was served. The latest Sevendori attempt at Povali cheese, and an incredibly well-made loaf of toasted rye bread. Not my dad's. I can tell somehow when he made the bread. But my brother-in-law was taught by the best. If I have no higher legacy in this world, bringing high-quality baked goods to Sevendor is one of my most satisfying. "Don't tell me you aren't open to a well-placed bribe," I jabbed at my friend and business partner.
"Me? Of course. But only if it's in our mutual interest. I've turned down more bribes than I've taken. Let a courtier get under my skirts."
"You jest, Min. I'm merely looking for access to the ducal court while they're in town,"
Bannermore assured, as he poured the wine. A sweet red Remiran, of course. Expensive. Now he was showing off.
"Why?"
Olmeg asked simply as he hacked at the cheese.
"For commercial advantage, of course,"
Master Loico answered. He was a war mage, but he'd also been an administrator of a conquered province. He was familiar with both politics and commerce. Just knowing a courtier can give a man commercial advantage.
"In this case, I'm looking to make friends that can facilitate some business in the southwest,"
Bannermore proposed. "The Westlands and Old Castal. We don't have a lot of exposure there, and there are a lot of good resources down there that could be lucrative opportunities. A friend or two in the ducal court could prove helpful."
"Just stay clear of Count Moran," Loico advised,
as a pretty servant set a large tray of pickled everything in front of us. His passion is power, not commerce, but he will use whatever means he can to achieve his aims. Is the good count to be in attendance? I asked, curious and concerned. If not he, then one of his agents, Loico assured. He has not let Tavod go without a firm eye on him since the lad learned to be standing up. Dealing with Moran's party is dangerous, he said, an observation, not a judgment.
Good to know, grunted the mayor as he stabbed a pickled egg with his belt knife.
I have no desire to end up some courtier's pawn or assassin's assignment. I merely wish to see Seven Door prosper, he shrugged. Moran is behind this damn fool idea of conquering Alshar by sea, or encouraging Tavard to do it.
That is complete idiocy,
Master Loico pronounced, sipping the wine. His opinion was authoritative as the only man to ever oversee the conquest of Faerys. He was as adept at sea as he was at land tactics. That's one of the reasons he was so highly regarded. Additionally, he was recently come from that region, and knew the intelligence about an Ultramar's forces better than anyone. The man is a fool even to consider it. The rebel navy is vast. Sending a few score hired Cormoran caravels against him is a waste of gold. A popular opinion outside of the ducal court, from what I understand, Bannermore mentioned. Within, it's nearly treason to say so.
How would you know such a thing?
Master Olmeg asked, as he picked through the cabbage rolls. It wasn't an accusation, just an inquiry.
I am a notorious gossip who is free with my wine, the merchant wizard said, as he poured more into our cups.
I have my own agents. People talk, particularly merchants. Hence, I'm well aware of his difficulty in raising the gold he needs to pay such fools. I expect we'll know the mind of the prince better when he arrives. And knowing he needs gold, well, that presents opportunities. There are many rights and lucrative boons that a desperate duke can grant, he said expansively.
And you've the purse to purchase them,
Olmeg nodded. Another observation, not a judgment. The big green mage did not value coin, but he did not begrudge those who did.
I should hope so, Bannermore nodded. Like gaining a trading franchise at the Wilderhall Fair, he suggested.
That was the biannual regional fair that brought wares from as far away as Wenshire in the east and Verone in the west, particularly wool. If the Seven Dory delegation had an invitation to the fair, it could be worth a lot. Without new possessions, he considered, we could bypass the wool merchants and sell direct at a greater profit.
Wool? Loico asked, amused. You have the ear of a prince and you wish to stuff it with wool, Lord Bannermore? Perhaps your vision is inadequate for your purse.
No, my friend. One must know Bannermore to appreciate his intelligence. Wool is a stepping stone toward greater things, Olmeg pointed out. The tolls alone make trade that far away prohibitive, unless you bear a trade pass which exempts you from all but the county tolls. Any profits you might have made are quickly swallowed. Once you secure a wool franchise to the fair, you're exempt. And if one can transport wool to the fair, one can also transport a great many other items. Merchandise unavailable outside of Sevendor.
What matters that, when you can now transport the product by Hoxter Pocket?
Loico asked.
Firstly, that's a trade secret, Bannermore said in a hushed voice.
The table was protected from casual eavesdropping by magic, but old habits die hard.
If that information becomes widely known, and it's suspected that we're quietly subverting taxation and toll revenue by transporting merchandise magically, we'll have serious political trouble, he lectured.
As far as anyone knows, hucksters are rare and special things only the most erudite amongst the magi can fathom.
Secondly, you cannot get into the far more lucrative inner market without a trade franchise from the fair. That's where the deep discounts and real profits are made, he said with relish. Otherwise you're stuck in the common market, trading small lots with local abbeys and estates.
That's a lot less worthwhile, he assured us. That sounds suspiciously like you're planning on founding a trading league, Loico said, amused, as he picked his way across the pickle platter. The Merwini League did that before the Dukes crushed them.
More of an arcane merchant guild, Bannermore corrected, a very quiet one.
Planus and Rael and I have been tossing this idea around for months now. That little trip into the Wilderlands was fruitful, Min. It established the infrastructure that we need to transport goods from the Wilderlands to Rhemir and back. When you put Sevendor into the equation, things start to get interesting.
But you'll catch holy hell if you're caught, I nodded. So how do you plan to turn this wool into gold?
Well, I'm just a rustic foot wizard,
the self-made merchant prince smiled, affecting a country accent. But if we can get a ducal, or even royal, charter for a trading guild, without too many specifics, we can use it to cloak our activities. We can ship living specimens, such as seedlings and herb cuttings, overland in the traditional manner, while we quietly continue to use the Hoxter pockets to transport mundane materials between the chapter houses, he proposed, without all of those pesky tolls and fees.
I rubbed my beard. That could work, even if temporarily. Until you got caught, I added warily.
I'm a rustic foot wizard,
Bannermore replied smoothly as the soup course was served.
We don't get caught.
But your point is well taken, which is why I would have this theoretical charter enumerate that any potential conflicts be handled by a tribunal from the ecclesiastic courts, not the civil courts, where the merchant classes tend to have more clout. There we can delay and obstruct the proceedings indefinitely.
What does that give you? Loico asked curiously, as he sipped the rich beef broth the attractive servant placed before him.
Time, Bannermore shrugged. Time to find a better political solution, or at least hide the evidence.
That seems a little devious for you to participate in, Olmec, I noted. Usually the big green mage has the moral fibre of a Kasari.
I'm just in it for the herbs,
the gentle wizard shrugged. This institution could ensure the widespread distribution of a number of promising species.
From how Bannermore described it to me, green magic would be the cover for caravans traversing the kingdom from border to border without serious toll. My colleagues and I would be very interested in that kind of league, he assured me.
We'd also use them to transport some of the more volatile enchantments and components, Bannermore agreed. All perfectly above board and legitimately arcane. Meanwhile, the chapter houses would be transporting the good stuff, the non-magical commodities that really take a beating in long-distance trade, like timber, steel, grain, salt, textiles, cheese, wine, he added, holding up his cup. We'd be trading those on the side, and making an obscene amount of profit.
Enterprising, Loco nodded. You're looking to become chartered smugglers.
Essentially, Bannermore agreed, without taking offence. You object, Lord Loico?
Me? The Wenshari war mage asked, startled. Not at all. I've dealt with my share of them back in Faris. I didn't take the crime personally, even as I had them hung. I was just wondering if you'd be interested in a Farisian connection, he offered, innocently enough.
Would I? With all that the great maritime markets there provide?
You have a local connection?
A misnamed scoundrel called Asselon the Fair, head of the Musaranya trading house, he suggested, a gleam in his eye. He's the kind of enterprising merchant who would fit well with your plans.
With a name like the Fair, he must be a scoundrel,
Bannermore said approvingly. His brother was one of the Mad Mage's apprentices for a while, before he got into, well, let us not dwell on the bad business he fell into. A terrible shame for a talented adept, but as I am occasionally open to a reasonable bribe in the interests of the greater good, I let Asselon persuade me to spare his brother's life. As a result, the rascal feels indebted to me. He's not a major player in the Farisi markets, but he's smart and he's ambitious. Now that his brother isn't running from the censorate anymore, he might be just the man to involve.
Can you trust him? I asked.
No,
Loico conceded, but you can trust him not to betray his interests, and he has a lot of good intelligence on what the other smugglers, I mean, merchants, are doing.
Sounds like just the scoundrel we could use, agreed Bannermore. This is a sound investment, my friends.
You always say that,
I pointed out, and you have profited tremendously by listening to me, he continued, undeterred. Really? A few thousand golden roses will seem like nothing when the profits from such an operation start accruing. Not only are Olmec and I partners in this enterprise, but Rael and the Enchanters Guild are in. Planus is in. Master Drainus is in, assuming he is made Count of Moros, as he desires. Even Pentandra is in, he added, looking at me.
Pentandra? She never mentioned an international arcane smuggling ring, I accused.
You should keep up with your memos, snorted Bannermore. How do you think she managed to feed Verone and cheat the grain merchants out of an expected windfall last spring? She and that wily cousin of hers used the Hoxter pockets of the supply rods left over from the Great March to exchange grain for timber and iron ore. They ended up making a profit on both sides.
I was wondering how they were managing to get by without plundering their reserve funds, I nodded.
Pentandra was smuggling. What would her mother say? Ask her next time you're in Verone. She's still there, Bannermore confided, and driving Penny absolutely insane. But she's the one who put me onto the idea. She wants to do it as part of some big construction project she's doing out in the Wilderlands somewhere.
I was at least somewhat familiar with that project, having put her and Carmella on the task. I hadn't heard a lot about it since she settled on the Anvil as a site, a remote stony hill with a prodigious overhang. It was far east in the Wilderlands, on a plateau protected by river and ridge from the goblins, and all but deserted after the invasion.
Yes, this would aid in that, I said without further comment.
If Penny was using this smuggler's guild to hide her quiet effort to build the Magi a refuge and fortress, I wasn't going to complain. Indeed, I felt her touch all over the plan. Pentandra often leads best by convincing the rest of us that the right course of action is our own idea. Sneaky. So, what do you need from me?
Well, Bannermore said, pleased that I was also supportive of the enterprise.
Firstly, you'd need to sign a request for me to appear before the Ducal Court, he said, ticking the items off his fingers. Then you'd need to prepare an application under your prominent and politically powerful name for the Duke to consider the charter, with plenty of flowery language elaborating why this would be ultimately for the good of the realm. Thirdly, you would enter into discreet negotiations with the court, likely Moran, the Prime Minister, about how much gold such concessions are worth. A quiet payment, in coin or draft, usually follows, along with ample discussion about the splendid merits and progressive thinking implied in the innovative order. Then you present a draft charter for His Grace's inspection, signature, and seal.
Just how do you propose such a guild would be organized? Lyko asked, as his empty soup bowl was replaced by a plate of tiny sausages fried with mushrooms.
Much as any similar guild is, Bannermore offered. The Mother House, here in Sevendor, of course, would operate as a central hub and scheduling center. The various chapter houses would be subsidiary, but would act as regional agents for our special consignments. Each would run a merchant house, open to the public, selling our guild's wares, while each would also retain the services of a local commodities broker to quietly sell the smuggled inventory.
Two sets of ledgers, he emphasized, his eyes gleaming. One for the arcane merchandise, which will rarely show a profit, and one for the mundane, which will show a very hefty and untaxed profit.
The latter set we keep to ourselves, he added unnecessarily.
That's going to require an awful lot of organization and coordination, Olmec said, doubtfully. Would not running a clandestine exchange for such commodities work better than individual contracts?
Olmec might look like the village idiot from afar and walk everywhere without suffering shoes on his massive feet, but he was not uneducated in the ways of commerce, particularly agricultural commodities.
If you had a small, central exchange with regular meeting times, the individual chapter houses could meet and settle their purchases at a common price. It keeps us from undercutting ourselves, he pointed out.
That does have merit, Bannermore agreed, his eyes squinting.
And use of the mirror array, or merely speaking mind to mind, can ensure the exchange is not troubled by delays, or overheard by the wrong ears. Planus has already used the damn thing to steal a march on his competitors, who rely on barges to send market prices downriver. Planus uses mind-to-mind or mirror messages with his agents, and can buy or sell at an advantage before the news is known to the general market.
That's nothing compared to smuggling, Lyko observed. A man who buys a bale of cotton in Barrowbell, or a staple of wool in Wilderhall,
and sells it for what they'll pay for it at the mills of Cormier, that man will make a fortune with every transaction, he assured. We're not the only ones who are pursuing a charter, Olmeg confided. Rael the Enchantress and the Enchanters Guild seek a charter themselves. I saw her this morning on the way to town. She's nearly got the funds she thinks will purchase the franchise, and she's hurrying to raise more. There's also a cadre of war magi, based out of the Staff and Sword, who seek a charter for a mercenary war magi's order, Loico added, as he devoured the last of the little sausages. Just some basic rights, the benefits of a professional association, that sort of thing. About time, he said with a grunt. I had to agree. We'd both been professional, itinerant, mercenary war magi for a few years, he more than I, and we both resented the censorate's prohibitions on forming such societies. Anyone else? I asked. This is starting to sound like a terribly lucrative pilgrimage for His Highness.
Actually, yes,
Olmeg said, setting down his knife. When the news came to town, Master Loico and I overheard a group of masons. That lot you have finishing up the keep at Cowland's Pass, discussing forming an order for arcane construction. I doubt they've gotten to the fundraising stage yet, though, he added. Considering what I'm paying them, they could probably take it out of their arms coffer, I said, rolling my eyes. But I can see their perspective. They aren't exactly using the same techniques as traditional masons. Yet they are getting guff from those traditional masons about how radically they've departed from Fargus rites. Fargus was the minor divinity that served as many masons' patron. A hybrid of imperial and Narasi influences, the Shaper of Bricks was far less sophisticated than his spiritual cousin, Avital. He was the god of stonemasons, not engineers. Some priests object to using magic to replace honest toil. We're seeing the same thing from the peasantry, with the rise in popularity of tilling wands, Olmeg agreed soberly. While the priests of Huin seem in favour, many peasants see them as a threat to their traditional rites. When a communal plough, or the toil to drive it, are no longer needed, he explained, then determining who owns how much of the harvest becomes problematic. This is the price we'll have to pay for progress, I sighed. I'll support all three endeavours, I suppose. The masons need protection, the war magi need regulation, and the enchanters... Well, I'm not sure what the enchanters need, but they don't get rowdy, so I'll support them. Excellent decision, sire, Bannermore beamed. And just the one you more or less forced him to make, quipped Loico, as a small but plump roasted fowl was placed before him with some ceremony. It was stuffed with berries and smelled delicious. I considered the merits quite carefully, I assure you. I told my new court wizard, if it means promoting Sevendor and increasing its importance, I'm in favour. Besides, it will give me something to distract His Grace with, so that he doesn't look around too closely while I'm scheming. Bannermore, have those documents sent up to the castle for me to sign and seal, when they're drawn up, and we can put this behind us and focus on important things, like street sweeping and public privies. Oh, I took the liberty of having all the documents in question prepared for your signature and seal this afternoon, while we were speaking, Bannermore said demurely. My law brother was working on it all day. I picked it up when I got here, he said, taking a tightly bound sheaf of 20 or 30 pages of parchment out of his sleeve. And look, a quill, he said, withdrawing a goose feather from his other sleeve, along with a small inkpot. How fortuitous, he continued, as he unrolled the imposing stack of documents for my approval. How convenient, I said sarcastically, as I took the quill in hand. Aren't you glad that you have me to take care of such details? Bannermore asked, jovially, as I scrawled my name across the page. It makes the rest of it just work so much more smoothly. Chapter 5. A Second Unexpected Visitor. It's not often that a baron gets to entertain his duke. Of course, it's always a possibility. A baron is merely the king's representative and stand-in sovereign for the duke's power and authority. A baron holds his lands, and those assigned to him by his liege, in the name of the duke, which implies a state of ownership, or at least authority. The possibility that your boss might choose to drop by and stay a few days is implicit in the position. There are baronies where no sitting duke has ever visited, much less been entertained by the baron. There are also baronies, mostly located fortuitously on the banks of busy rivers or at heavily travelled crossroads, who see far more of the ducal court than they'd like. But to have a duke come to a barony on an official visit was the epitome of political and social aspiration for most baronies. Me, I would have rather skipped the entire thing, or held out for a royal visit. But mere barons don't get to instruct their betters like that, so when the notification came that His Grace, Tavard III, would be spending a few days in Sevendor on a tour of County Lensley, I had to shut my mouth and pretend to be both impressed and grateful, when I was neither. There was overt political purpose in the visit. Since the respective defeat of Westphalia and the Sashtalian Confederation, the Duke felt compelled to tour the affected area and inspect the new barony Baron Arathaniel had carved out of Sashtalia for his younger son. Ostensibly to check on the county's preparation for war, Tavard had the perfect excuse to get an appreciation of just how far Sevendor had come. Giving me only 2 weeks' notice before his arrival was the feudal equivalent of a snap inspection, in military terms. While it gave us enough time to tidy up the place, if we'd been doing anything suspicious, it would not be adequate time to hide it, or something like that. I wasn't worried. The things I was hiding were already well hidden, or required understanding and intelligence I was pretty certain Prince Tavard did not possess. But that didn't mean I didn't prepare. The moment I got the letter, I informed Lady Estret, who acted in Alia's stead as Lady of the Castle, and Sister Bemia, the castle chaplain, and let them get to work. The cleaning teams were deployed within the hour. "This is a magnificent opportunity for us to show off our barony," Sister Bemia said proudly at breakfast a few days later.
This is a disaster,"
Lady Estret said, her fair features contorted into a weary frown. She'd been working on getting the castle ready since the moment she knew about the event. Castles. She was also overseeing the sprucing up of the gatehouse, where she and Sire Kay and their family resided when in Sevendor.
"But think of the honour that will fall to us," Bemia had countered. "When they're gone," she added.
That didn't seem to mollify Lady Estret. By the second day, she was already looking fretful as she dutifully went over the list her husband gave her to accomplish. Out of his earshot, she didn't mind complaining directly to me. She and Bemia didn't hesitate to corner me at every opportunity as they rushed to prepare.
"You do realize that half of Sevendor looks like a construction site right now?"
she began, anxiously twisting the ends of her long blonde hair as if she was spinning.
"There are cranes and stock piles everywhere. The Great Hall is totally inadequate for a proper reception. There are no quarters in the castle suitable for a duke. Every cot and hold will have to be thoroughly cleansed."
"Do what you must, within reason," I acknowledged, "but don't go out of your way. If Tavard wants to see Sevendor, let him see Sevendor. A slightly cleaner than usual Sevendor," I amended, seeing how Lady Estret winced. "With my parents preparing to return to Talry now, we can move my sisters and their families into town for a few months, and their graces can stay there," I suggested. "It's nearly new, and we can make it suitable for their delicate ducal sensibilities."
"That might work," she conceded, biting her lip.
"And then my sisters will be able to brag the rest of their lives how the Duke and Duchess once slept there," I added, quietly amused at the thought.
"And the reception?" Lady Estret asked, doubtfully. "There has to be a reception feast. A court," she emphasized. "There must be a holiday court. Where can we allow the Duke to hold a holiday court? This place is entirely unacceptable."
"Then we shall use the new hall at the gatehouse," I decided. "It's almost finished, anyway, and this will be an ideal way to break it in. And then Sire Kay can have the pleasure of bragging how he feasted the Duke and Duchess in his hall once," I smiled.
"You do realize that will bring up the subject of your new fortification?"
Sister Bemia asked, concerned. "There has been enough talk in the Bontal of how strong it is.
It worries some. Having His Grace dined there will bring attention from a royal level," she warned.
I can't very well stick it in my pocket, I dismissed. It's a big castle. It was bound to be noticed.
The excavations into the mountain will also be noticed,
Bemia pointed out. That is the focus of the Karshak's efforts now. I've already spoken to Guri and had him shift the bulk of the work parties on finishing the gatehouse, I informed them, and perhaps give them a holiday. Oh, we can disguise the mine head for now and explain it away as quarry work for storage. That shouldn't be too difficult. The neatly drawn plans Guri showed me at the beginning of construction eventually had a pair of 8-story towers built against the face of the mountain, with a towering spire that would, eventually, be seen clear to Chepstow Castle. But even with a squadron of construction magi aiding the effort, that vision was years away from being realized. Right now, the front of the cliff looked relatively normal for gleaming white enchanted basalt. Only at the base, concealed from ready view by the massive gatehouse itself, was the cliff disturbed. That was the entrance to the interior sections the Karshak were excavating first. It was obscured by a long canvas tent, used for storage and such. As of yet, there was little sign of what was happening within the mountain. The entire operation could be tolled away at this point, I reasoned, as quarrying for stone for the gatehouse and the Muse Tower, which a separate crew had begun work upon. That was Dara's refuge and laboratory for her work on the Giant Hawk project. It was only about 5 stories high, built on a shoulder of the mountain beyond the crevasse. But when the top of the spire was complete, it would eventually be seen above the tree line.
I do hope you appreciate everything we're doing here,
Lady Estrid said, in a rare display of ire. Our love for Lady Alia compels us to represent Seven Daughters sincerely as she did. I changed the subject abruptly. I hated when they spoke of Alia as if she were dead. I'd called a council meeting for dinner in the Great Hall, after the rest of the folk finished eating about a week and a half before Brigger's Day, to discuss preparations. It was an expanded council, consisting not just of Sire Kay and the castle administration, but the Seven-Door Town Council, representatives of all of the temples, a few yeomen, and a number of wizards. By that time, word had saturated the Vale about the impending royal visit. Some of the details of the entertainments and contests were leaked, and there was a spark of excitement in the air that rivaled the mage lights overhead. We got a surprising amount of work done at that dinner. That's what you get when you hire good people. Bannermore anticipated the visit with great eagerness, proud of the little town he'd worked so hard to build. Master Olmeg was nearly as excited by the prospect of showing off his magnificent greenery. The others saw the visit as equal parts opportunity and burden. Great lists of projects were drawn up, and for once, no one complained about the expense. The consensus was that this was Sevendor's opportunity to shine in the royal eye as the first mage land, and everyone wanted that. Thankfully, I had adequate subordinates who knew their work. Once I outlined what I wanted to happen, they made it happen. It was like magic, only a lot easier, and vastly more expensive. Once given their tasks, the Sevendori went to work. The fields took very little preparation, thanks to the Master Olmeg's good stewardship and the liberal use of ploughing wands, while the rest of the Bontal was struggling to drive their iron ploughs through the still cold, wet soil, Sevendors were already prepared to take seed after the last frost. Zagor assured us there would be at least one more. That freed up a lot of labour for other projects, and I didn't spare the coin to pay for them. One crew finished paving the road from Bovol Hall to Brestal with cobbles, one of the last main roads in the domain to be done. The dike tower was given a thorough renovation, repainted and cleaned up. New banners were hurriedly sewn. The tal worked from dawn to dusk hauling debris and garbage that had piled up over the long winter. Gallons of whitewash were distributed to every hamlet and cot, so that the buildings looked clean and almost as white as a snowstone castle in the distance. Sire Kay and Sir Festaren placed huge orders for victuals, wine, and other delicacies from Sendaria Port and beyond. Inns and taverns did likewise. Meanwhile, Bannermore enlisted the aid of 12 magi. There were always plenty of those around town, especially around the Enchanters Guild, to lay down enchantments to augment the engineering and beautification projects. The public fountains,
which now extended water clear to the street of Magi in the north end of town, were given mage lights that activated at dusk. They glowed to life at the same time the street lights did, illuminating the splashing water in changing colours. Bannermore even built two new public privies at his own expense. A week before the visit, Master Olmeg's furry minions deployed hundreds of spring wildflowers in small clay pots throughout the town. With a bit of enchantment, they began to bloom early. As for me, I mostly just paid for it all. That may seem terribly lazy of me, but in truth I was not concerned about whether or not we would impress Tavard. Of course we would impress Tavard. The man was easy to impress. What concerned me far more was impressing Tavard the wrong way. While my retainers scurried around me to ensure the best possible presentation, my mind explored all of the dark ways in which this visit could go wrong. Wars had erupted over such excursions. Feuds and duels had occurred after a state visit in the past. That was precisely the kind of thing I wanted to avoid. My goal was to be entertaining, forgiving, in light of our recent history, and utterly supportive of Tavard's rule and eventual ascension to the throne. That was difficult, because Tavard was not only personally annoying, but his succession had also ensured that his powerful mother, Queen Grendine, had essentially abandoned his sister Radin to the clutches of her captors. Radin was her second in command of the kingdom's intelligence service, not to mention difficult to marry off, so the queen saw her daughter's sacrifice as a political tool. Hanging around court, Radin was a threat to Tavard's rule by her very existence. Though regrettable, in her eyes, having Radin safely in the hands of pirates awaiting ransom negotiations kept her out of the way. Only the queen knew very well that Radin was not in the hands of mere pirates. She'd been traded, like a sack of meal, first to the Brotherhood of the Rat, and thence to the hands of Korbal, the necromancer of the Mindens. I know she knew that, because I'd told her myself, after learning the fact after Yule, when my former apprentices returned from Olam Saheri with the intelligence. Yet Grendine kept the public fiction that her daughter was still being held in an ultramar by pirates, and a suitable ransom would be negotiated any time now. There could be dozens of reasons for that. A few of them might even make sense. But the woman's willingness to use even her children as pieces in her game of power was distasteful to me. Radin, for all of her faults, had been utterly devoted to her mother and the family, the unofficial name for the official kingdom intelligence apparatus. Rad, at least, had vowed to punish the miscreants who took her, and offered two baronies to the man who rescued her. But even those were token efforts, designed to appease propriety, not to secure his daughter. In fact, they served Prince Tavard's ambition to conquer an ultramar from the sea in his own name, as it was unlikely any adventurers in an ultramar would find her there, and the two vacant baronies pledged for her recovery were currently recovering from an aborted goblin invasion. Instead, talk around court was centered on the dedication of the new palace and the building of the new royal fleet, and that was really why Tavard was coming to Sevendor. Fleets are expensive to construct and maintain, more expensive than armies. Instead of building ships, Tavard, who was ostensibly in charge of the invasion, was hiring ships, naval mercenaries, from Rhaemir and even Merwin. They were gathering in the east even now, arming and preparing for an autumnal launch. But the Minister of the Treasury was not free with funds for such an endeavour, much to Tavard's dismay. The costs of the palace, the smaller revenues collected from the lands affected by invasion, and the price of fielding troops in Gilmora and elsewhere was already straining the new royal treasury. He was given a mere 10,000 ounces of gold to begin his effort, and was told by the royal council to raise additional funds on his own. He'd borrowed a like sum already. Now he was shaking down his vassals. That was why he was touring Castal, not just to see the countryside and check on his vassals, but to extort money from them. It only took me an hour to verify, through mind-to-mind communication with my magical peers. Tavard was putting pressure on every noble he could to donate funds to the cause. My discussion on that front was interesting, and Astaral helped bring me understanding. As a native Gilmoran noble, he understood what was happening better than I.
You have to remember, Min, that Tavern is not just prince and heir. He's also the sitting duke. One way that the ducal houses have traditionally kept rival powers from emerging from among their vassals is to tax them into obedience. If he has a legal cause to do so, he can raise funds from them as a way to keep them from gaining too much military or political strength. Likely that's why he's put Sevendor on his itinerary. He doesn't like you, I'm aware. Just how much do you think he doesn't like me? How much will he hit me up for? From what I've heard, he's pushing for an average of 1,000 ounces of gold from each barony, he reported. Ifnir's dice! That's almost a decade worth of tribute! He's entitled to ask, and then either grant favours or impose penalties to encourage you to pay. Reluctance is often seen as a sign of disloyalty or ill intent. If a baron has just reason to refuse, or such a payment would bankrupt him, he can usually appeal to the temples for intervention. But few high priests want to get involved in that sort of thing.
I can see why. Well, it's not like I don't have it. He'd have to ask for significantly more than that before it would be a problem. But I hate to fund an effort I know is doomed to fail. There's no way Tavard's mercenary fleet can outmatch the rebels, from what I understand. They've already got the fleet at Faris tied up in knots after Radin's capture. I might as well just throw my gold into the sea.
Oh, let the lad do it for you, Astaral counselled with a chuckle. He's more than capable. Just be gracious and pay up, Min. If you do it, then your neighbours will too, and that's what he's likely after. Your good example as a loyal and obedient vassal. No doubt, he reasons, that if anyone would start a rebellion against him, it would be you.
Me? I've only been in one little rebellion. I've been a model noble. I've paid my tribute on time and in full every year. Even my paperwork is in order. Rebel? Hells, I don't want the idiot's title or his responsibilities. I have enough of my own. Just trying to look at it from his perspective, he soothed.
Astaral was correct, I discovered through other sources. As the ducal party made its way upriver from Castabriel to Wilderhall, it was stopping at most of the major baronies along the way. And he was, indeed, shaking them down like a thug from the slums. Sevendor was a little inconvenient to that trip, but I hoped to make the excursion worth His Grace's while. The day after I spoke to Astaral, things got even more complicated. Although I didn't realize it at the time, I was in my laboratory, lecturing Ruderal on some obscure point of magic while he swept the place clean, when a mage named Ostri contacted me hesitantly, mind to mind. Ostri had been issued a temporary stone, having come onto my staff as part of the reserves for the holiday. He'd been assigned to duty at the Dyke Tower, acting as the spell warden for magi seeking entrance to Sevendor. He was young, strongly talented, and imperially trained, and he'd been making a little extra coin working for the regular Bulutirian. I liked the kid. He was smart.
Mage Lord Minolin, he began, I was instructed to contact you if anything unusual or noteworthy happened here.
So, which is it? Unusual or noteworthy? I quipped.
Both. I have a gentleman here. Well, I have a man here who seeks an audience with you. Mage?
Anyone I know?
I don't think so. Do you know any sea magi?
I abruptly stopped what I was doing and searched my memory.
No one worth mentioning, I admitted.
I met a few on the docks and in Faris, but no more than passing acquaintances. This sea mage wants to speak with me.
Yes, Mage Lord. He said he is an emissary.
From whom? Perhaps the pirates who captured Radin wanted to negotiate?
He says he's from the sea folk. He's here to see the one called the Spellmonger.
I tried very, very hard not to pass out on the spot, and then recover enough composure so that I wouldn't sound panicked in front of my subordinate. That's not professional.
The sea folk? How interesting.
Have him escorted to the castle, I instructed. I'll ensure that he's hosted here. See if he wants anything to drink, I added, for no particular reason at all.
Shit.
Shit! How could the Fundle have taken notice of me? Why, in the name of Nine Hells and Ishi Soki Crotch, had the sea folk even heard of me?
And why did they choose the week before an important state visit to decide to drop by unexpectedly? I resolved not to panic as I prepared for my second unexpected visitor. I knew the Vandal occasionally used human sea magi as translators and ambassadors from their massive leviathans when they happened to interact with humanity on the open sea. There was a whole damned cult associated with the mystical nature of the Vandal, the Seamasters, one I dismissed as mere nonsense, until recently. Not even the Censorate had bothered trying to control them. When the criminal you're chasing can step on a ship and go anywhere in the world beyond the Censorate's jurisdiction, it's hard to serve a warrant. Why the hell were they here? Why now? Of course, my mind leapt to all sorts of unlikely and horrific reasons, with even more terrible consequences. Images of chitinous warriors forcing men, women, Alka, Alon, and Gervani alike into the ocean to our collective doom filled my mind. The knowledge that I had the ancient shades of their most revered ancestors locked up in my cellar increased my anxiety, and every dire warning Lelastian had given me about the precarious position our races enjoyed in regard to the sea folk came back to me. I needed to stall him, at least a day or so, I reasoned, while I completed some preparations. I could do that. I was the damned Baron. I didn't have to speak to every itinerant mage who wandered up to my door, I reasoned. I had enough going on to reasonably beg off an immediate audience. It was late enough that I could put him up in one of the guest halls in Southridge, or in one of the inns in Sevendor Town for the night, and deal with him in the morning. I had my reasons for the delay. Tonight was an important night for me, professionally, as it was when some of my top magical experts were supposed to convene inside the mountain. It was the last such scheduled meeting before the Brigger's Day holiday, and I was anxious to share my news and forge some progress toward my eventual goals. Having a fishy-smelling wizard from the sea folk hanging around put a damper on the evening. I tried to put it out of my mind, after I contacted Bannermore and had him intercept the sea mage on his way to Sevendor. I could trust him to entertain the man without raising suspicion, or asking too many questions. I just couldn't be distracted from what I was doing tonight. But I couldn't. An hour passed, and while I was trying to work out a few last-minute calculations before the meeting, my concentration was shot. I considered contacting Pentandra and seeking her advice, but that would just upset a pregnant lady. It wasn't worth the price to salve my jitters. Instead, I turned to the other expert at my disposal. I used the sigil we'd contrived to add her to my growing fisherman's net of advisers and contacted Lelastian mind to mind. "How is Alia doing?" was my first question. The issue of the sea mage and the Vandal sunk in priority the moment I contacted her.
"She's fine," the Sorceress of Sartha Wood assured me. "She's doing well, actually. She took a long walk beyond the gardens today, in company with one of the Tal she's adopted as her maid. She smiled over dinner last night."
Minor things. Tiny victories, I knew. But each one gave me the tiniest bit more hope, another minor measure of optimism. That kept me motivated.
"Excellent. Tell her I love her," I asked,
though I knew Alia had only the vaguest awareness of my existence.
"Look, I hate to bother you, but... well, there's a sea mage at my threshold who wants to speak with me."
I could hear the mental snort.
"Is he looking to sell you an enchanted dinghy?"
she joked. "No. He says he's an emissary of the Vandal, the sea folk, and he wants to see me."
"Oh, shit, Min,"
my new ally said, anxiety pouring out of her mental voice.
"That's bad."
"Well, so much for my quest for reassurance," I replied dryly. "After what you just told me about them, I'm tempted to slip out the back door and slink away. I could always become a baker in the backwoods of Vore or something, much less likely to cause an inadvertent exile of my species from this world that way."
"No, gods, no, Min. If they came, you can't ignore them. Do you realize how incredibly rare it is for the Vandal to send an emissary ashore this far? To parley with coastal authorities, perhaps, or to negotiate passage through contested waters, but you're about 500 miles inland of where they usually roam. This is bad, Min.
You think?
I asked sarcastically. What do I do? You're the expert, I reminded her.
Well, you don't slink out the back door. If they came, you have to entertain them. How many?
Just the one, Sea Mage.
That's good. Better than I thought. If it was a serious visit, they'd send an entire delegation. It might just be a casual inquiry from one of the breeding pods, or a request. Shit, Min, how the hell did they know who you are?
I have no idea, I said sulkily. I do try to keep a low profile.
Treat him as an honored guest, she advised. The Vandal don't think much of us, but they do see honors and respect for one of their emissaries as noteworthy and admirable. If they think that they have business with you, it's best to treat that with all due solemnity.
They are the landlords, after all.
Exactly,
she sighed wearily through the connection.
I don't know what more to tell you, Min. Just be careful. Be respectful. Be polite. Don't have him summarily executed or anything like that.
Hey, what kind of mage lord do you think I am?
I just thought I'd mention it, she said defensively. Listen respectfully, hear him out, and seriously entertain any proposals he might have. When dealing with the Vandal, it's best to be as deferential as possible. Can you fake that, at least?
Hey, I repeated. I'll have you know I've been kissing Noble Ass for over 5 years now. I can fake deference. I just want to know why he's here, and why he picked the week before Tavard shows up to appear.
So do I,
she agreed unhelpfully.
Do let me know when you find out. Not to change the subject, but I received word from a very unexpected quarter that someone else wants to speak with you, here, in private. Not in Sevendor. Lord Eritas.
Really? Why?
Because his daughter Falowin is somewhat reluctant to get married to that Humani knight of yours, and it has him perplexed. Despite his antipathy toward me, when he discovered I was on parole, he asked if I wouldn't speak to her.
Did you?
Of course. I have more experience with human-alkan social interactions than anyone, she boasted. That's one of the reasons those hidebound, close-minded traditionalists on the council were so eager to lock me away. The scandal of interspecies unions was just too much for them.
Lelastian sounded like she wanted me to ask about all of her tawdry encounters with my distant ancestors, but I didn't have the energy to entertain her. I had a meeting to get to, an important one. Tell him I'll pop by tomorrow night. I can speak with him then. Perhaps I can soothe her nervous jitters, although I don't know how. That will also give me a chance to tell you what the Sea Mage says.
I'm looking forward to it,
she said unconvincingly.
400 years without much in the way of company gives a woman a desire to entertain.
Chapter 6 The Bouliotterion of the Handmaiden. In the bowels of the pure white mountain behind my pure white castle, there are laboratories where only the finest enchanters worked with the most exotic of materials in my service. I had spent a lot of time, money, and energy ensuring that the Karshak had built the lab out of solid snowstone to my exact specifications. It was a model lab, a series of dream workshops that even the Ark Magi would have envied. Within were some of the most advanced enchantments of our age, being developed by some of our finest minds. Experimental magic, using the novel powers of the unique crystals from the mountain, combined with the mysterious powers that lingered here. Among the underground facilities was a special suite, 3 rooms devoted to my personal projects. Chief among those, at the moment, was a plan to reconstruct my cracked witch sphere, and improve it dramatically. I'd been getting by with loner stones from my collection, perfectly adequate for normal use. But I wanted my big, powerful ball of green amber back, and if we could improve upon it, so much the better. To that end, the Alka Alon Songmaster on Ranyan, Master of Shaping Irionite, was working with Master Asguri, the Karshak Stone Singing Master, and Master Ulin of Setria, the foremost human enchanter of the age. At various points, other experts were brought in as needed in an effort to plan and build the perfect magical device, the culmination of their combined arts. The thing was, recent events had changed our plans.
When Alia was magically maimed at the Battle of Greenflower, her chances for recovery were negligible. Even the hands of the gods could not bring her back to me. I was quietly urged to consign her to an abbey, annul our marriage, and seek another wife, while I'd sulked in despair for months afterwards. And I'd recently learned that her potential salvation could lie under one of the most fearsome places on Kalador, Ulam Seheri. I'd learned from Lelastian that there was the enneagram of an ancient creature, known as the Handmaiden, that could, theoretically, be brought back to unlife and used to restore my wife's mind. So the focus of my expert staff had changed since I'd returned at Yule. The plan was no longer focused on making me more powerful, but on figuring out a way to contend with the transport and use of the Handmaiden's enneagram should I actually have the chance. Therefore, I'd taken to calling the group of arcane experts the Bouleuterion of the Handmaiden. It was a thaumaturgical, cross-disciplinary masterclass, and it was my best hope to execute my vague and poorly thought-out plan. The problem is, if you want to go carting enneagrams all over the place, you have to store them in something, usually some kind of crystalline matrix. And for an enneagram as large, complex, and sophisticated as the Handmaiden, no normal crystal would suffice. Indeed, the only one we'd seen that was capable of handling the shades of the ancestors of the sea folk was the Snowflake. That was a semi-stable quasi-malapar of ever-changing crystal I kept down at the end of the hall. It was dressed with the enneagram of an ancient celestial mother, a being more powerful than any six human gods you care to name. Only a fraction of it was connected to the crystal, but it was enough to provide incredible power. But we only had one snowflake. We couldn't move it, and it was occupied. If we could not find a way to transport the Handmaiden, then going to Ulam Seheri was futile. Lately, our efforts had focused on actually removing the center of the ever-changing crystal, which, for the barest fraction of a second, occasionally became entirely unconnected to the larger snowflake. The problem was that, despite its crystalline composition, the snowflake was enough like a malapar to make it essentially unmovable. Whether or not that was sufficient to block our efforts remained to be seen. I was pretty determined. Obsessed, even. When I arrived, I saw that Master Ulin had covered an entire wall with imperial formulas as he tried to work out the details of the plan. The others were already there, along with Master Loiko, my new court wizard, and one of the best thaumaturges I'd ever met, Sir Taran the Sage, Warden of Greenflower. I'd had my misgivings about posting the young war mage to the post, not because I doubted his abilities, but that handing over that grave responsibility to anyone would likely depress the hell out of them. Taran was just too nice to have to not only deal with the issues of being a powerful tenant lord, but also contend with the strange and uncanny issue of Castle Salacis, where the dead go for holiday. Dunsellan of Greenflower's mad attempts to recreate the snowstone effect had actually yielded some results, but they also drove him mad when they affected him. Taran had spent a year studying the strange substance that resulted. Instead of lowering the etheric density in a given area, the bluestone seemed to allow a far more tangible connection to the material world. In practical terms, that meant that the shades of the dead had a lot easier time manifesting there, and spells involving the other world worked particularly well there. While Taran had learned an incredible amount during his tenure as Warden of Greenflower, it had taken a ghastly toll on the man. He looked tired and worn, his once youthful face lined with worry and anxiety. Speaking to the dead bears a cost, and it wasn't one Taran was particularly well suited to bear. But the insights he had gained at Castle Salacis were invaluable. Every month, he had faithfully submitted a report about his findings as he made his way through Dunsellan's notes and records of his experiments. They were somber and sometimes horrific accounts, not just of his research, but of facing the results of Dunsellan's research, as that included two of my children, and a number of other children that had been bred directly as a result of his and Isali's madness. I read every report with especial care. Taran welcomed every time I summoned him to Sevendor for consultation as a result. He pounced upon any opportunity to retreat from that haunted castle. "I've got something," Master Ulin said, without formality, the moment I entered.
I'd long ago established a more collegial environment in this deep underground laboratory.
It's only theoretical, he cautioned, but it sounds pretty intriguing.
He told me about it, and as crazy as it sounds, it might have merit,
Masteraj Guri admitted grudgingly.
Only one of your folk could come up with something this convoluted.
Really? I thought it was quite elegant,
Onranyan sniffed.
Tell him, Ulin.
If we place the snowflake in a Hoxter pocket, he said, after taking a deep breath, the shift in the temporal component might be enough to weaken the bonds that hold the center point in place, he proposed boldly. I thought about that. That's an intriguing approach, but I can see a lot of problems. First and foremost, can you even get the snowflake in a Hoxter pocket? And then there is the issue of striking it while it's inside the pocket, at the precise moment, with the precise amount of force, which is going to be difficult, since Hoxter pockets kill anyone who goes inside of them.
That is a challenge,
Ulin admitted. Do you have an answer for it yet?
That's the challenging part, he said with a shrug.
Some divine assistance might be helpful, suggested Taran. You know a few gods, don't you, Min?
I snorted. Not one that might be useful. Right now my divine favor extends to baking, rutting, and marching, and not much else.
Avital could work,
Taran suggested thoughtfully. He's imperial, but I've mentioned the idea to the Avitalines, I informed him. The ancient order of monks had a passion for preserving the mysterious ways of our ancestors. There are ways to invoke him, it is written, but depending upon which aspect you summon, it could be disastrous. Remember, he's the one who helped Kefan the Damned sink Perwin, according to legend.
That was a mere miscalculation,
Onranyan muttered. I heard he was given the wrong figures.
Could have happened to anyone.
Regardless, unless you can find a good way to invoke him, we're on our own. But this is encouraging, I nodded, looking at the equations on the wall. Let's see if we can figure a way around the problem. We spent 3 hours chewing on the issue from as many perspectives as possible. 3 schools of magic, 5 wizards, you'd think we would have come up with something. It was 3 separate problems. How to generate that kind of force, which was considerable, how to project it with precision, and how to do so in the Hoxter, if the snowflake could be stuffed inside one. We discussed potential solutions for all 3 issues, and came up with some rather innovative ideas, but no real answers. Taran's insights from his work at Greenflower were particularly intriguing. He'd been asking important questions from an impressive list of dead people.
I do have some things I've been working on,
he admitted, when Onranyan insisted that he needed a better glass of wine for further thought.
The blue stone has some very interesting thaumaturgical effects. I've done some experiments and it expands the dimensional potential of spells, he said, struggling for the right words. I don't know, I don't really have the right vocabulary to describe it yet. I have to invent it as I go.
Expands the... what do you mean?
It's complex,
he said with a sigh. But it's become apparent that the attachment to the other world, the stone supply, can augment many spells, sometimes in unusual and unpredictable ways. For example, when you try to enter into the other world in their proximity, it's as easy as falling into a well. That's almost expected, I suppose. But then I noticed some of the effects I was seeing in simple thaumaturgical essays. Complexities in the responses that you can't imagine, he said reverently. Enneagrammatic spells in particular are affected. Common enchantments gained additional results. Others are almost impossible to control. I'm still trying to define the rules of how it works, but it's complex.
You aren't defeated, are you?
I teased.
Me? Never,
Taran said with a tired grin, a bit of his old spark coming back to his worn face. I'm not unenthusiastic about the workmen. You have to believe me. But you also have to understand just how draining working in Salesis is. Every moment in its proximity is like walking through a crypt on an icy day.
But the work is worth the sacrifice,
he assured me, especially now that I've built this.
He pulled the baculus out of the magical pocket he'd stashed it in. It was a simple and elegant thaumaturgical rod of deep red werewood. It was enwrapped with spells, and studded with stones to produce various magical effects. But the staff head was unique. The head of the baculus was a smooth sphere of bluestone, polished to a shine. "Meet Threshold," he said, presenting the 5-foot-tall, intricately carved staff of werewood. "It's a special thaumaturgic baculus I use around Salesis. Dunsellin had the wood in storage when he did the spell. They were in the area of effect. There was actually a decent supply of them, but this was the best of the lot. The calcium inside the cell is transformed," he said, answering my question before I asked it. "Even without this big marble at the top, it's different than any other werewood in the world." "Paracletic?" I asked, professionally curious. "Not yet. I haven't found an enneagram in the grain that I trust with it. The wrong one could be disastrous with this stuff. I'm still working on it, but so far it has some fairly unique abilities." "Like raising the dead?" he suggested. "Really?" I asked, surprised. "It's necromantic," I asked, recalling my recent conversations with Kedaran about the subject. "Only for a few hours, and only the recently dead, but it's promising. You can also use it to see into the other world without actually going into the other world, which can be useful. And you can use it to detect non-vibrant enneagrams." "Wait, what?" I asked sharply. "Non-vibrant?" "Oh," he said, shrugging, as if it was an afterthought. "Studying at Salesis has given me a deeper insight into how enneagrams and life magic work," he explained. "Dunsellin's notes were surprisingly helpful. The man was a wart on the arse of humanity, but his library is exquisite. There's ample scholarship on the subject from the late Magocracy. You should really read a few of the Merwini codicils," he suggested. "In all my free time," I said, rolling my eyes. "Give me the high points." "Most of the enneagrams we're used to working with are either pure thaumaturgical constructs, or they're control mechanisms and architecture grafted onto basic elemental patterns, right?" "Basic thaumaturgy," I nodded. "Sure. But we also know that living beings not only contain enneagrams, but are the source of some of the most complex. A cockroach has a far more sophisticated sense of self-awareness than, say, a water elemental, for instance. But more importantly, the cockroach's enneagram isn't just the chance repetition of a primal elemental pattern. It's the product of biological functions and responses. It grows. It changes. It thinks, after a fashion. It utilizes the inherent magical energy implicit in metabolism and higher functions to form its enneagram. Life energy, he emphasized, when the Gavani or a necromancer sacrifices a living thing, what they're doing is harnessing the energy of that life energy as it's converted. It leaves the enneagram behind as a residue of sorts, like draining a wineskin or taking your clothes off, he said, searching for an adequate metaphor. Your tunic and hose still look like you, kind of, but they aren't you. We can reanimate it after a fashion, using a necromantic architecture and a lot of energy, but we can't give it vibrancy. That only comes as a byproduct of living metabolisms. As it is, the necromancy converts the arcane power into necromantic energy, death energy, as it transforms direction into action. Threshold, he said, hefting the staff for emphasis, can detect those necromantic energies, even the very faint ones emitted by mere elementals. That could come in handy, I nodded, impressed. That also might explain why Hoxter pockets kill living things, but allow enneagrams like paracletes to pass through unharmed. They aren't vibrant. Exactly, he nodded, excited. The Hoxter pockets don't have the capacity to contain vibrant energy. They don't have the dimension available. The moment a living thing enters the pocket, its vibrancy is destroyed. But where does it go? I asked. The magosphere? Taran shrugged. That's a damn good question, Min. I hadn't gotten that far. It could be, he agreed. All I've done at this point is to throw chickens into the pocket and examine them when they come back out. Their enneagrams aren't stripped, as I originally thought. They're intact, he informed me. They're just dormant.
It's their vibrancy that's been destroyed. I can usually reanimate a chicken that's been through a huckster, especially in Salacious, he reported.
You have undead chickens in Salacious, I chuckled.
Too many, he chuckled. The animation spells last an obscenely long time, too. They guard their old roosts day and night, never sleeping, slowly rotting away. We haven't had much trouble with foxes and rack-eels lately, or chicken-stealing peasants, but I'm convinced. It's the vibrancy of the animals it destroys, not its thaumaturgical pattern of self-identity.
What would it do to an undead? I asked, curious.
I tried that, Taran nodded. Put an undead chicken inside a huckster, the necromantic energy is drained too. But it can be immediately reanimated as the architecture of the Enneagram is intact. You'd need an independent power source, like Irionite, to sustain a necromantic field, but it should come right back.
Oh, I sighed.
So it wouldn't kill Sherul.
No,
he could sustain himself indefinitely in a huckster with the proper power, Taran said, shaking his head. Although it would get pretty lonely in there, if you could get him in one to begin with. The kind of reality-warping field that much Irionite creates would likely keep him from sliding into a huckster.
Theoretically, I prompted.
Theoretically? Min, all of this is theoretical, bordering on whimsical bullshit, he said frankly. We barely understand Irionite, have a vague idea about Snowstone, and Bluestone is just weird. Hucksters? Theory is all we have.
And that stuff? He asked, pointing at the big lump of what looked like molten glass swimming around in a big transparent urn.
What in five hells have you been up to, Min?
Oh, I said, my lips going tight. That. Something Brigger and I cooked up one night.
What is it?
As far as I can tell, it's a pure physical arcane medium, I said uncertainly. But ask me again next week and I might have an entirely different answer.
He looked confused.
Doesn't Brigger know?
She's in inspiration, not analysis. That's my department.
Our department, I corrected.
It's a liquid medium, extremely viscous even at room temperature, and it's thaumaturgically responsive, I added.
Beyond that?
Any way that it could be used on our current problem, he proposed.
Not that I can think of, I said a moment later. And yes, I really did try to think of something.
Then let's adjourn to the Chamber of the Snowflake, suggested Onranyan, returning from the storeroom with two fresh bottles. We can at least test this mad theory by seeing if the damned thing will even go into a huckster. Of course, with the energies involved, we could destroy ourselves.
Or it.
Or the world,
he shrugged.
Shall we pawn before we go?
Master Ulin cast the spell for the huckster. He was by far the most adept with the largest of the two remaining pocket stones at this point, the third having been stolen by the Enshadowed, having learned all he could from the Karshak's imperfect understanding of the artifact. While he was preparing, Taran used Threshold to examine the snowflake, and returned from his surveys with a puzzled expression.
That is odd, he said mostly to himself.
Master Ashguri grunted. It's an eternally evolving piece of magical crystal.
What's so odd about that?
You know, it doesn't really exist in the other world, he announced.
But I've seen it, I protested.
You've seen the ripple effect in the other world caused by its presence, but the snowflake itself isn't there.
That's pretty subtle, I observed doubtfully. It has an Enneagram. Dear gods, it has the most spectacular Enneagram I've ever seen. It's sucking in arcane power like a hole in your pocket, but it lacks vibrant energy. There's a little necromantic power there, enough to disturb the other world. But the snowflake, as a form, isn't there, he pronounced confidently, as he peered past Threshold.
Should it be?
Not that I know of, but I expected to see something there. All I see is the wave form around it. It's just odd.
I think that I'm ready to start now, Ulin called from his place in front of the snowflake. He had the largest of the pocket stones in his hand, and a concerned expression on his face.
You're worried? Master Ashguri asked, cocking a bushy eyebrow.
About trying an untested thaumaturgical experiment with a barely understood dimensional magic on a unique quasi-divine immovable artifact? Ulin asked. Nah, I live for this shit, the master enchanter declared. Despite his mousy exterior and mild demeanor, I did not doubt his dedication one bit. Indeed, he was as fervent as any knight in the lists, tilting with a rival. I took a moment to appreciate my chief enchanter. He'd ploughed through the intricacies of the General Bulutarian's most advanced offerings like they were a Reeves report on hay production. He didn't ask for more than the stipend I paid him. He lived in a flat rented from Bannermore and spent every third night in the workshops. He'd made me a fortune, by any estimation, just by overseeing the production of agricultural wands and heat stones. But here he was in his element. This was the kind of work an enchanter dreams about. I was actually envious at his professional fulfillment. Specialists can enjoy that sort of thing. As a generalist, I mostly ended up frustrated. Ordinarily, casting a hoxter pocket, once you've prepared yourself, is a relatively simple matter. But this was an unusual occasion, so Taran was lending a hand as monitor, watching with threshold and keeping an eye on the etheric currents and such. Ulin nodded to Master Ashguri, who began a deep, throaty chant that I'd come to associate with the art of stone singing. According to the plan, this was just enough contact to slow the snowflake's rate of change, but no more. Then Onranyan joined in, his Alcan song spell preparing the region to be affected by the Hoxter. It was unusual and thrilling, this odd combination of three schools of magic on one project. To my knowledge, nothing like this had been attempted before. A few moments later, I discovered why. It looked like it was working at first. A field started to form around the snowflake, and it looked like it was fading into the pocket, the way it was supposed to. But then it stopped. The field failed to coalesce, though it persisted in trying. The snowflake slowed its transformations to a near halt. The pale light it always emanated seemed to intensify, and the snowflake seemed to push back against the attempt. Then it erupted in a bright white flash of arcane power that engulfed us all and knocked us off our feet. I didn't quite lose consciousness, but I was stunned for a few moments. My head pounded with pain, and stars flashed before my eyes for several seconds. "Is everyone okay?" Taran asked, concerned. The mage lights in the chamber had been extinguished, and the only light came from the pulsating snowflake. There was smoke and the smell of ozone in the air. "What in six fiery hells happened?" swore Ulin, recovering his hat and dusting it off. Master Ashguri exclaimed something in Karshak, and Onranyan shook his head a bit. "Well, that was explosively disappointing," Master Ashguri said, struggling to his feet. "We should probably not do that ever again," Onranyan observed solemnly. "Not for a long time," moaned Ashguri. "My head is pounding." "Let's not be hasty, gentlemen," Master Ulin said, whipping out a thaumaturgical wand. "It wasn't a complete failure. There was definitely